presented by Topps.
Check out Topps Project 70, celebrating 70 years of Topps baseball cards. That's right, this is Spin Rate, the Athletics Blue Jays podcast. My name is Drew Fairservice, and we are here talking about the All-Star break. No, we're not talking about the All-Star break, although it was a great event. I really had fun watching the All-Star game. Of course, Vladimir Guerrero Jr. named MVP, hit a home run, drove in another run after Teoscar Hernandez doubled, driven in by Vlad. Bobichek got in the game, looked good. Marcus Semien scored a run, I'm pretty sure, and the game was good. It was breezy. It moved along. And of course, as is tradition, the American League won. Great break for the Jays, who are getting ready to start their season back up again. But since last we spoke, when last we spoke, Caitlin and I broke down the draft a little bit, but we are not draft people. So what I thought I would do this week for Spin Rate is talk to Jeff Paternostro of Baseball Prospectus, who is a draft person, who is an amateur, someone who watches a lot of games, has seen a lot of the players that were drafted. And we had a great chat as well about, you know, Jeff lives, I believe, in Hartford or just outside of Hartford. So he sees a whole lot of Blue Jays AA baseball, the New Hampshire Fisher Cats. So before I talk to Jeff, which I did, and I'm excited for you to hear me talk to Jeff, I, of course, want to remind you to subscribe to The Athletic if you haven't already. Go to theathletic.com/spinrate. It's the name of this show. They'll give you a tidy deal. You can have a year-long subscription. Do that up. Subscribe to The Athletic. Read Caitlin writing about the draft, writing about the All-Star game, writing about the future, writing about the top 15 trade targets. She did a ranking of them. And Caitlin, as she admitted it out loud on Twitter, that if she had put Joey Gallo any lower on her list, she put him as number 3, she wouldn't have been able to come back on her own podcast, which is true. I would not have spoken to her ever again. So Caitlin did a really good job breaking down who's out there for the Blue Jays, who's most likely to be their targets, their priorities. Go check that out, of course, once you go to theathletic.com/spinrate and subscribe to The Athletic. You can subscribe to this show, whether you subscribe to The Athletic or not, anywhere you get your podcast. So Spotify or Apple Podcast or Stitcher or Overcast, wherever. Go subscribe, drop us a like or a rating or a review. That makes me feel great. Even when the reviews are negative or constructive, I like those too. I like anything. I like validation. So go give it to me. Give it to us. We're having a great time here. Halfway through the first season of Spin Rate. And we're just past the All-Star break, as I said. We're just past the draft. So now, with no further ado, I'm going to talk with Jeff Paternostro of Baseball Prospectus on this edition of Spin Rate. Jeff, thank you so much for taking the time to join us.
Right. I actually have some free time now since we published our midseason 50 and did all the draft stuff. And now it's just a little bit of quiet.
The draft is over. Like you said, the midseason stuff is over. Minor league seasons are in full swing for the first time in a more than one calendar year, which is probably exciting for someone like you who spends a lot of time in the minor league parks watching these guys. I think we always bring it up whenever you and I speak. Excited by anyone who is outwardly a Sheffield United supporter. Sorry, Sheffield Wednesday. Oh my God.
Wow.
I can't believe this
almost got bad.
Yeah.
Well, you're better than NBC Sports and the Premier League commentary team to just refer to them as Sheffield now for the most part, which is even more annoying.
That should never happen. How do you feel about Wednesday this upcoming season? Are they a relegation risk, or are they maybe looking to get up?
They got relegated to League One, so we're enjoying some League One football this year, which will be great. And they got relegated the last day of the season by Wayne Rooney's Derby County, which is just the worst possible way to go out. It had been coming for a while. They had a points deduction because they screwed up selling their stadium to themselves and didn't file the paperwork properly. So they had to take a 6-point deduction. They're out from all under the financial fair play stuff now. So they have been able to actually make some moves. They brought in Darren Moore at the end of last season, who used to manage for West Brom and was in League One last year with Doncaster, I think. That's probably not correct, but he knows the league. He started to scoop up championship players and Premier League players that have been on loan there and are now out of contract. So the squad's getting younger. It's getting pacier. They have, they've gone down with most of their best players from the championship. So it's set up that they should be able to compete for a top six spot and bounce back up. But as a longtime Sheffield Wednesday fan, I never really get my hopes up. So we'll just have to see how it plays out.
It seems a lot better that way. Yeah. I'm surprised. I don't know that I've been following League One and the Championship too much. Wigan in League One. That's crazy.
The last few years, yeah.
That's crazy. Yeah. They, you know, it's hard with the, when you get. And hold on a second. Okay, now I'm distracted. I'm sorry. I apologize.
No, there's some big clubs down there.
Jimmy Flint Hasselbank manages Burton Albion. Wow, that is exciting.
He's a hot managerial candidate for a few jobs, like maybe 2 or 3 years ago, I think, before he was at Burton.
Good for him.
Yeah,
I got nothing but time for Jimmy Floyd and Hasselbank, but we're not here, unfortunately, to talk. I could go on and on. As you may know, this was a big season for me as a West Ham United supporter. Yes. I spent a good 40 minutes today trying to plot out what teams could end up in the group stage draw that have direct flights from Toronto. I got a lot of eggs in the Frankfurt basket right now. I need West Ham and Frankfurt.
Nice place to go watch a game too. Anytime you get into one of those old Bundesliga stadiums, it's a nice midweek evening match day experience.
Except for the fact that I would force myself to be with the traveling West Ham support, which would be a nightmare, truth be told. Like, all cards on the table.
Yeah.
Over here in Canada, it's all fun, it's novel. But to be like in amongst the rabble could be a little dicey. All my good friend who is a Palace season ticket holder, he and his wife, like, incessantly, when I was there and I went to West Ham, mocking West Ham supporters incessantly, but also in their mockery revealed them to all be exactly like me, which is really, really troublesome. Like,
Belgium? I guess there's probably no direct flights to Belgium. I feel like that would be a fun away day too.
From Toronto, you can fly direct to Brussels, and then it's only like an hour on the train to Antwerp, who are in the draw
that's
as
a nice
well.
One
so,
too.
You know, I'm like, yeah, Italy is a little too far.
Yeah,
a little too
expensive. I'm sure it'd be cool to go to the, you know, to go to see, I guess, Roma's in the.
No, it's Lazio, which I would not do.
Okay? Obviously. I couldn't remember who finished fourth. Atalanta's in the.
Yes, they are.
That's
Bless
a nice
them.
Stadium, too.
Bless them. And a lovely
team. I
think
they finished remodeling it now. I know they were playing elsewhere in the Champions League.
I am a. If Evan was to have a backup team, my Italian team is Roma, so I will not go to Lazio for a million different reasons. Again, the exposure of the weird political alignment between West Ham and Lazio is, again, that stuff I can't get into that. I don't need that knowledge in my head.
I'm now trying to imagine David Moyes setting up to defend against Atalanta. So,
oh my God,
what that would look like.
My good friend Dustin Parks, from people who listen to this podcast probably know well, he is a newborn Atlanta ultra, loves it, loves the way they play. He had a good tweet in the Euro. It's like, if you're watching a team and you don't know what, and then you see the best player on the field for them, you don't know where he plays, the answer is almost always Atlanta. And it's almost always true, unless they're Czech and they play for West Ham. The knowledge in your head about European football stadiums may be the information that I want, but we can do that off the air. Let us talk about some of these new found teens that are within the organization, within the clutches now of the Toronto Blue Jays. How about we can start with the draft. The Blue Jays had the 19th overall pick, and they drafted a guy with a pretty good handle, Gunnar Hoglund. Hoglund? Hoglund.
It's a good question. I'm not sure.
SEC guy, they seem to love SEC guys.
Needs Tommy John surgery.
Needs Tommy John.
Already had Tommy John surgery at this point.
So is this a case? I mean, obviously, maybe Alec Manoah was a bit of an extreme example of getting a, you know, 2-3 talent at the fifth pick. Is this the kind of guy that, were he healthy, he would not have fallen to the Blue Jays at 19? Is that fair to say?
Correct. And I think there were a lot of directions they could have gone here. I think because they didn't have a second round pick, which they lost when they signed George Springer, there is value in not having a second round pick. Also means they don't have second round pool money. So being able to get a back of the top 10, like I think he probably would have gone 8, 9, 10, 11, somewhere there in a normal draft year, he was healthy and continued to pitch well for Ole Miss all season. So to get that guy, within the confines of the smaller bonus pool is, and to get that guy with not having a second round pick. So you can't really, you know, get another top 50 talent in the draft. Mm-hmm. To get the best single player you can get there and stay within the slot parameters is a really good move. Now, he's a pitcher with Tommy John surgery. And while that is common, it's not necessarily routine. Every recovery is a little bit different. Every Tommy John surgery is a little bit different. They have the luxury to take it pretty slow with him. You probably won't see him on the field till maybe the end of 2022 in sort of like a rehab environment. Maybe it's the Arizona Fall League to stretch him out and then probably move towards more of a normal college arm pitching development schedule in 2023. So it is for a guy that you're taking that was, if he had stayed healthy, arguably one of the most major league ready arms in the draft outside of maybe the Vanderbilt duo, like as a starter, like Sam Bachman could probably pitch in a major league bullpen right now. And some other arms that went in the first round as well. But he is a guy that, again, not a ton of upside, but a very, I want to say safe because he has Tommy John surgery, but a good, solid mid-rotation starting pitching prospect, better than you would find at the 19th overall pick in most years. And I had, so, is that enough of a hedge?
No, that is a good hedge. But so I guess, you know, the thing that I took away from kind of reading about him a little bit, and as Caitlin and I discussed on the weekend, is his control, I guess, is kind of his big, is the tool that's graded the highest. Yeah. And also maybe he's got like three kind of above average pitches, which sounds to me like a starting pitcher, as long, you know, obviously you can keep the ball in the ballpark, but those are, that's a pretty good starting pitcher kind of opening or starter kit, I guess.
Right. It's not a guy that's probably ever going to be, he might get to top 50, but never has maybe a top 25 prospect in baseball or a top 5 starting pitching prospect in baseball. But some number of these guys do, because of the way the pitches interplay with the command and the control profile, you know, some of them turn to number 2 starters. Jack Flaherty is a good example of this. Mike Soroka is a good example of this. Those are prep arms and not college arms. And maybe you still a bit less with college arms because you get a better feel of what the college arms actually are. And like, you know, Nick Lodolo is this guy to an extent too with the Reds. He's left-handed, which does make a difference for that kind of thing. But there is certainly, I don't want to say there's no upside here. You're not going to look at the, it's less to dream on, I guess. Mm-hmm. If you know, it's not like Andrew Painter, where you look at this big prep arm out of, you know, Florida with projectable stuff, and it's already sitting mid 90s and a lot. So this isn't that guy, but this is a guy that was a college performer with multiple major league quality offerings and major league quality control and command.
It's not, I feel like in sometimes, especially in the draft and in the first round, to call someone like a high floor guy can sometimes be a bit of a pejorative. It's like, oh, high floor, like this is what he's going to be. Just based on what you've said, it seems like, again, that's not who he is, but there is a high floor, again, because of those kind of the way that those command control and the three, you know, good offerings kind of come together.
Right. And of course the injury muddles that some, and you have to see how he comes back. And that's why he was there at 19 instead of going at 9. So that's baked into it. You know, you could have gone with like Colson Montgomery there and taken a prep shortstop out of cold weather that will flash 5 above average tools on any given day, and you're not going to see him until 2025, I guess, something like that. But so there's a number of directions you can go, but you know, Montgomery was, you know, he went 22 to the White Sox, was probably projected to go about there. And to, you know, again, anytime you can get a talent that normally would not be available at the place where you're picking, and do not have to spend significantly over slot. Like I don't know what he's actually going to sign for, but I mean, I would suspect you're not taking him there if you don't already know the number. So,
No, that makes a lot of sense.
I don't like to, like, I hate using the word value. I feel it's kind of like, I don't know, needlessly like depersonal and overly catchy and economic, but it's a good value pick. And at the end of the day, that's what we're talking about. Anytime you have this kind of bonus pool structure that Major League Baseball and the Players Union has agreed to, you're going to have to make this kind of calculation.
We'll be right back with more Spin Rate, but first, check this out.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them. You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
The player the Blue Jays did take in the third round, Tariq Tiedemann, is a, maybe a bit more of a project junior college guy, not unlike Blue Jays fans will probably, I think Nate Pearson is probably the most recent junior college guy that stick up in their mind. What do Blue Jays fans need to know, or what can they look forward to in a pitcher like Tiedemann?
So he is a project. He's been a two-way player. He's a lefty, low 90s at present. Because of his limited reps on the mound and his general physical projectability, he'd get a little bit more than that. It's an advanced changeup for his age. Like, he's unusual in that the changeup is ahead of the breaking ball at present. It's good stuff. He doesn't always fill up. Like, in some ways, he doesn't have Hoglund's command and control profile. And if you watch him pitch, you can see why. It is very effortful mechanics. It's not the most repeatable delivery in the world. He's athletic enough to be around the zone with the fastball changeup combination, which will certainly get it done at the JUCO level. He's going to be a little bit more of a slow burn, I think, than some of the other college arms they've taken. Like, I would expect him to go to Dunedin to start next season. Like, I don't know who's going to pitch post-draft and who's not going to pitch. Every team's going to have their own plan. Like, I wouldn't be shocked. I don't know how much he threw at JUCO, and if you're looking at his workload in a way and managing that, but looking forward, you know, normally you think third round college pick starts in advanced day. That's kind of the blueprint, you know, even a JUCO guy, but I think he's going to be a little bit more of a slow burn. Just the key for him is just getting professional reps, developing the breaking ball, getting those mechanics streamlined a little bit, and, you know, working on throwing good strikes with everything that he has.
He's just the kind of guy where maybe it's a bit of a bet on the player development system as the Blue Jays have it. Like, you know, they've made a lot of investment and make a lot of, you know, talk a lot about this facility they've got and their belief in their high performance team and all that sort of stuff. Maybe this is a guy that sort of fits into there as, like, we can really provide him a place to blossom.
Sure. I mean, one of the major changes you've seen, I think, throughout player development within the minors and even the majors in the last 5 to 10 years is that teams are no longer view the draft as you take the best talent available, you water them for 2 years if they're a college pick, and, you know, 3 or 4 years if they're a prep pick, and you get what you get. And that's sort of like this, you know, preordained, unbeatable path. You're just trying to take the best talent. Teams really started to look at, what do we do well? I don't know if the Blue Jays have necessarily figured that out yet from a player development standpoint, but, you know, across baseball, you're like, what are the skills that we're particularly good at maximizing? Can we find players that have skills that already have present skills that we don't think we can maximize, but there's some tweak we can make here and there? Michael Bauman wrote about this at The Ringer fairly recently, the idea that we've seen a shift towards teams taking maybe guys that don't quite throw as hard as traditional starting pitching prospects. Maybe they have a little feel for spin and good command, and their teams are more comfortable teaching velocity and command. And it makes sense. It's probably easier to increase fastball velocity than increase general strike throwing ability, at least consistently across a larger population of pitching prospects. So I think there is this idea that, okay, like, again, I can't speak to the specifics with Tiedemann, but maybe they're like, okay, we're really good at teaching. We're pretty confident we can teach this guy a good slider. So that's why. And that's like the one, it's fastball changeup guy right now. We think we can teach him a good left on left slider to give him a you know, a glove side option. And that's like the missing part here. Or we think we can tweak the mechanics and bring a couple more miles an hour out of him. And yeah, okay, maybe he ends up a reliever, but now if he's sitting 95 plus as a lefty reliever, that gives, you know, that gives him late inning possibilities. So it is a lot of looking at, and even overarching, looking at the Blue Jays draft as a whole, it was very clear that they were trying to restock pitching within the system, which is not, you know, with Manoah graduating, you're looking really at like Simeon Woods Richardson and then not a whole lot of impact arms. And, you know, Hoglund, we say it's not a ton of upside, but a mid-rotation starter is an impact arm by any definition as a pitching prospect. Sure. And if you can get Tiedemann to that level, going to take longer, going to be a little more difficult, more downside risk. You know, anytime you can get players with that potential, it certainly can reshape the pitching within your system and the way you look at it.
So a couple other guys, we don't have to spend too much. Let's talk a little bit about Irv Carter, high school arm from Florida. Everybody saw the draft, the video when his name was called. Awesome scenes at his place, the whole squad in there having a good time. Maybe afraid of high school pitching isn't the right word, but there's obviously a lot more risk associated with a prep arm like that. But what is it that Carter brings that Blue Jays fans perhaps can get excited about?
Yeah, I mean, if you look again at sort of their track record of non-elite right-handed prep pitching prospects across the draft the last 20 years, it's not great. Carter, I mentioned Andrew Painter already. He went from the same high school as Painter, so there's always, this happens whenever there's like big pitching prospects because the scouts are in town anyway and they tend to stick around and guys get looks that they don't, might normally not get if they were just sort of there by themselves, and they sneak up into the fourth round like that. And I guess Carter was the fifth round, but he's, you know, it's, again, it's not all that different from Tiedemann. He's right-handed. It's good fastball velocity. It's a bit of a project arm. Similar, it's a very, very upper body arm heavy delivery. So I do wonder if they can streamline that a little bit and get the same kind of velocity, but make it a little more repeatable for him. You know, he's another guy that's going to be, I think, a slow burn, but you're looking at, it's a good frame. It's sort of a present starting pitching prospects frame. He's still a little room to fill out. So you can see him kind of developing into that, you know, that sort of broad shouldered workhorse of a mid rotation arm. It's fastball slider at present. I'm told there's a changeup anytime there's a prep pitching prospect. I saw Frank Roncicato up here a fair bit. They went 7 overall to the Royals because he played about a half hour from me. And I haven't actually looked to see if there's any scouting reports on his changeup. He threw 1 in 3 games I saw. I did not know it was a changeup until I looked down at my radar gun because they just spiked it in the dirt. But yeah. He replicated the arm speed well, so I can say he had good feel for the changeup, or some feel for the changeup. And that's just, these guys don't throw changeups. And why would you ever, if you're 95, and I know Carter, like Painter, was pitching in a fairly competitive high school leagues in Florida. I mean, they're tough. There's a lot of good prep talent down there, obviously. But yeah, he's not going to need a changeup. So that's obviously something to work on, but you're looking at a potential, it's a very sort of traditional day two, mid six figures prep power arm. You know, sometimes these work out, sometimes they don't.
It's the thing I keep saying, I've been saying, is it's more art than science at times in the draft. And but the 2020 draft, the Blue Jays got a bit of a gift, maybe with Austin Martin, who I don't know if fell to them is the right word, but he played in the Futures game this week, just ahead of the All-Star game. I'm not sure if you've gotten a lot of looks. I guess he's playing this year in Double A out your way. You know, this is obviously, again, like a college bat guy who has a big hit to a lot around his ability to put the bat on the ball. What have you seen in him this year? And maybe like, is he looking like he's going to be on the move, or still a lot to learn at Double A?
It's just an aggressive assignment, relatively speaking. Like it's not shocking in general if a very advanced college bat, you know, top 5 talent certainly in that draft, goes to Double A, their first full professional season next spring. it wouldn't be that unusual. But what would have happened in a normal season, you would have had a full season at Vanderbilt, you would have been drafted, probably would have had some full season eight ball time in July and August last year, and you just would have had a better feel for it. You would have adjusted to professional pitching and sort of the rigors of the pro game and stuff like that. And he got off to a terrible start in New Hampshire. I talked to a scout that saw him early and was like, I don't know what to do with this. He does like, it doesn't, nothing is popping. Mm-hmm. It just, and again, because it was an aggressive assignment, you had spring training and then you had the weird sort of alternate site for a month. And then regular minor league baseball started up, and it's, you know, it's a weird schedule with sort of the 6 days on, 1 day off. It's, everything's a little bit, and having like sat on some of these series in Double A, everything is a little bit weird. It's been bad weather up here too. So there's been a lot of double headers, a lot of missed games. I've watched players sort of struggle to get into rhythm, I think. And I think we're starting to see the latent ability that had him regarded as a potential first overall pick last year come to the forefront now. For me as an evaluator, and this is something, it's just like, I hate his setup. I really do. Like the way he starts with his bat pointed towards the pitcher almost, that's a thing where I see it. I'm like, wow, is he really going to be able to sort of get the bat in the right place as he's loading it? But he does. He repeatedly barrels baseballs, and at a certain point, it's just like, all right, your swing's your swing, and that's what works for him. It's something I do, like, I'd like to see him dominate that level a little bit more. I'd like to see a little bit more power. He's never going to be a huge power guy. Mm-hmm. I'd like to see his slugging like start with a four for a month before I maybe move him up to AAA. You would have expected in a normal season him to get there by the end of the year. I think he'll probably get there by the end of the year, especially with the extended AAA season. He was always, I think, going to be more of a 2020. It's not impossible he could have been up this year, but I always thought he was going to be more of a 2022 guy long-term. He's another where it's, again, sort of the nature. Look, we ranked him, I think, 20th on the midseason 50 or thereabouts in the 20s. Like, that's an impact prospect. It's just not the shape when you think of like a top 25 shortstop or center field prospect, and he's played both this year. You think of like everything a little bit, like that scout said, you want it to be a little bit louder. Like, even if he's not a big power guy, you want him to be like hitting a lot of doubles, you know, hitting 300 plus, really making plus defensive plays in the field. And he's more of just like a steady performer type. But, you know, at the end of the day, if it's 280 with a 400 on base, if it's an 800 OPS that's on base heavy, and he hits 280 and he can play up the middle, even if he's not going to win a gold glove there, you look down at the end of the year and you're like, yeah, this guy was a 4-5 win player. And it never feels like it, mm-hmm. but he brings value in so many different ways that go beyond just being able to, you know, put the ball over the fence or win a batting title. Now, the flip side of that is there's downside risk if that hit tool starts to slide a little bit against better pitching. He hits like 250 or 240, 250, 260. Can that guy still play every day, especially with the defensive flexibility? Yes, but now we're talking about a guy that hits like seventh in your lineup rather than maybe second or third. And it does kind of, you know, mute the offensive impacts. We say there's not necessarily a carrying tool here. There's not one skill that's going to stand out and force you to put him in a major league lineup every day. Everything has to play to projection.
So it's not like you're describing at the end here, you're describing like a right-handed version of Kevin Biggio, which is...
I like when I was saying that, I was thinking, but Biggio does have, I think, legitimate raw power. Mm-hmm. It might end. Like, I think I wouldn't be shocked if like the on-base percentage and slugging numbers end up looking kind of similar, but he's going to do it with more singles than walks functionally and fewer extra base hits. But that kind of like, yeah. And I know Biggio, I saw Biggio a lot in the minors, and, you know, he was also an older prospect for his level. I guess Martin is now too with the last year, but I'm not shocked that Biggio turned into what he did. It was probably maybe, you know, he's shown a little bit more power than I thought, like up into the majors. The batting average is probably about right. It's just his ability, I think specifically, and like Martin has this too, his ability to just stand at 4 or 5 defensive spots just gives you so much more flexibility to get his bat into the lineup. And I know Martin's only playing shortstop and center now, but I'm sure you could waste some time at second and the corner outfield spots as well. So he could be that kind of like 5-spot guy where the anchors for me, the anchors of the Blue Jays teams right now are, you know, Bo Bichette at shortstop and Vlad at first. And you just, if you got guys that can move around that and play a bunch of different spots and you know, leverage their bats in the lineup and just do like a bunch of like funky things with your defensive alignment as well. I think that that's something you should be seeking out. You shouldn't necessarily like, look, if you can get Marcus Semien, he's going to play every day and be great. Great. Dude, you can do that. But having the guys where even if they're playing, I think Martin will be a regular, but like a 3 to 5 day a week starter and be able to move them around based on pitching matchups or when somebody needs a day off, you know, Bo Bichette needs a day or two because he's just swinging too hard and he's tired. It's like that. You need to give him a breather. Like he can go in and play shortstop for you. He can go in and play center field for you. I think that certainly has value. You know, is he going to be, you know, his triple slash line is never going to look like Spencer Torkelson, but I would not want to see Spencer Torkelson play shortstop. So I guess that's the flip side of it.
You gotta give to get, right? This is a bit of that give and take. So, it's interesting to me. So obviously, as you've mentioned, the Blue Jays have some real anchors, guys that are entrenched. And I think that a sort of semi-recent trend among the Blue Jays is kind of converting prospects, minor league guys who have ability, not unlike maybe an Austin Martin, into big league talent. Trading from some of the depth that they may have built up in terms of player development. And obviously, that's maybe what a lot of fans are looking to for the Blue Jays to do right now. So there are a lot of kind of names that are that get bandied about and in terms of potential trades. There are some that you might see there at in New Hampshire when you're covering. They've changed the name of all the minor leagues anymore. Double A Northeast, like what?
Double A Northeast East Division, I think, yeah. Or North Double A Northeast North Division, whatever it is.
Yeah. It's the Eastern League. Let's just like
the Eastern League. Yes,
let's just call it what it is. Eastern League. But So some of the guys that you might have seen or see, are there any ones that maybe the Blue Jays would miss? Say the Rangers are like, we hear you're interested in Joey Gallo. These are some of the names that we want to see come back our way. If it's Jordan Groshans or Elvis Martinez, who off air you said is kind of Rangers-y, you know, are any of these kind of players the ones that you absolutely would not include, or is there somebody on Double A that you're like, that's a guy that would be a great piece to move on, or just, you know, when the Blue Jays are looking to make some of these deals, what names might we expect to see? I guess
I don't necessarily believe in the idea of untouchable prospects per se. There are prospects I'd be more willing to move in certain deals, and I don't want to say the Blue Jays have like a flat system, but I think there's a lot of ways you could go based on various teams' preferences. So I think a team could look at that Double A team and really buy into like Samad Taylor's swing changes. And I don't know where he's playing on. I mean, look, if he can really hit this, you just find a place for him. Like you just have an everyday second baseman argument. But if internally you're a little less bullish on that, you think he just swings a little bit too hard and the barrel control is not going to play against better pitching and sequencing as much damage as he's doing on contact right now. Yeah, I mean, that's the guy that you look to move. Maybe I think I was thinking about this when you said you're going to ask me, and the guy it would hurt me to move the most right now in that system, I think, is Gabriel Moreno. I just think that I'm not saying he's the best prospect in that system. He was on our midseason 50 until the injury, and because of the nature of a thumb injury for a catcher, we dropped him for somebody else. He would be in the next 10 still. If he comes back, he's probably done for the year, but I'm not super worried about that being like a long-term thing, but it's just something you want to see. But just, man, he can really hit. And the loss of the defensive reps behind the plate for the rest of the year, I think, are going to be sort of the biggest, the most deleterious effect of the injury to me as an evaluator, more than I'm not really worried about him coming back. And you know, hand injuries can linger for a little bit, but I'm not really about the long-term thing. But just, he needs defensive reps. I know they started playing him at some other positions too, maybe accelerate the timetable on the bat, but it just looks right. I think he's a guy that can really be like 280 to 300 with 20 home runs as a catcher. And like, look, maybe he's not the greatest receiver in the world. Maybe it doesn't matter in 2 years when he's ready, because it's an automated ball strike system. And as long as the pitchers are okay, you know, throwing their slider down and away and comfortable that he'll block it, and you know, the arm's good enough to control the running game, like, it doesn't matter anymore that he's a minus 5 framer, because that does not exist. That is no longer a thing you have to worry about. And you can put your really good offensive catcher that has, you know, can do everything else all right, right back there. I mean, just, I don't, that's a guy I don't, I would really have to be, I don't say blown away, but I would really think long and hard if, like, if I could get them to swap in somebody else, I would, at like that general prospect level, you know, let's call it back end of a top 100. And there's a couple guys that are going to be in consideration for that beyond Moreno. I would just think, yeah, I might rather trade Simeon Woods Richardson. I'd rather do that. And again, it's you know, maybe a team is really looking for a bat more than a, it's tough to do like pitcher position player comparisons in that regard when you're dealing with these kind of trade packages. But I'm just saying, like, if I had to trade somebody that I think is going to be like at least an average regular with serious, like, you know, upside past that, like, Moreno's not the guy I'd want to deal. Like, I'd almost rather deal Robles Martinez, who I like, who Steve Gaivars, who's seen him down in the complex the last couple of years, really likes, just because he's so far away and there's a lot to dream on there. But like Moreno, that bat's really close to major league ready.
That's interesting. You know, that's something that I know we've talked about on our show a lot, talking about maybe the idea of a player like Alejandro Kirk as a more ideal trade candidate. While he has shown he can hit at the big league level, they have trusted him to catch, you know, the big league pitchers in important games. Maybe there's a bit more risk in the Kirk profile, given his size, given, you know, well, his size is a big thing, but I mean, there's just, for me, I've said this before, there's like a perfect amount of information out there about Kirk to really make him attractive in trade to somebody else, where when you have the luxury of having a Moreno waiting behind, maybe Kirk is a guy that you're able to kind of dangle around and get something nice in return for.
Well, this is always the problem with trade speculation. And I know it's middle of July, so this is all we're going to do for the next few weeks. But you really, like, the Cubs just traded Jock Peterson to the Braves for Bryce Ball, who has been terrible this year in April. And it's just, I don't know if that's the guy I would have picked out of the Braves system for a Jock Peterson rental. I don't know if the Braves would trade me something better than Bryce Ball for a Jock Peterson rental. I don't know what the Cubs individual pref list looked like. You can't, they're like, it's very, very rare that I look at a trade and say, well, that played out like the exact way I thought it would in terms of the players coming back from, and I'm not even talking about like whatever the Rockies were doing with Nolan Arenado. I'm not even talking about like the weird outliers. I'm talking about like a pretty straight up, let's say Jose Berrios gets traded from the Twins. It's a very standard sort of above average major league starter, durable, 1.5 years of control left. There's a model, there's like a value model for what that trade's going to look like. You see it, you know, most years. You know, the Blue Jays traded Marcus Stroman at basically the same point in his team control, and, you know, got back Simeon Woods Richardson and Anthony Kay. So you can like literally look at that like, well, that's the, yeah, maybe it's not two pitchers, but that's the model of what, but you don't know what the acquiring team is looking to move. You don't know what their internal evaluations of their own prospects are. Yep, the Blue Jays might think Gabriel Moreno is a much better prospect than Austin Martin right now. I don't have that information. I don't know if the Blue Jays would tell me the truth if I asked them, because they certainly have. I certainly get another team scout to tell me what they think, but that guy's not in the room when the Blue Jays go and trade for Jose Berrios. So there's a lot of other things. I mean, there's like the information we just don't have on the players themselves. Also, the information we don't have on how the teams value the players. So I can sit here and tell you that I wouldn't want to trade Gabriel Moreno. Maybe the Blue Jays are sitting there like, well, we don't really think he can catch, and we really like Alejandro Kirk, and, you know, we value the sort of the defensive nous that Reese McGuire, but whatever, there's any number of reasons that you would come up with, be like, oh, we're trading Gabriel. His value will never be higher. He's injured right now. We don't think he's going to come back from that. Yeah, that sets his timetable back, and we're looking at our competitive window for the next like 2 years or whatever, like in the short term, whatever. The Blue Jays should be competitive forever at this point with Bo Bichette and Vlad just signing the lifetime contracts now. But there's so much that goes into these kind of decisions, and you can evaluate, like, look, we can sit back and relitigate the Marcus Stroman trade now if you really want to, but you really have to kind of make these decisions because there's opportunity costs in all of these, right? There's maybe Gabriel Moreno doesn't pan out. However, if you trade Gabriel Moreno for Jock Peterson, like you should have done better than Jock Peterson for Gabriel Moreno at this point in time. Mm-hmm. And there was an opportunity cost to only trade for Jock Peterson. So this all comes into the end. Like, look, I'm going to write transaction analysis for the next like 3 weeks now for every prospect that's traded, although there have been fewer in recent deadlines than maybe 4 or 5 years ago. And I'll tell you what they are. I'll tell you what I think they're going to be. I can't really evaluate. I mean, I can evaluate their present value in my mind and in my staff's mind, but I can't really tell you. I'm not a soothsayer, unfortunately. It would make this job a lot easier.
It would make it a lot easier. Make it a lot easier to, they would have you in the front office there in the director's box at Sheffield Wednesday. If you were able to see the future, you could see them coming a mile away.
That would be, somebody's got to be in the director's box there. They don't have a director of football. So that's probably something they should do at some point.
You're not going to get an argument from me. I have been brought along to understand the value of a director of football. More Spin Rate coming up right after these words from our sponsors. The only other thing I want to ask you about, because I know you and I have spoken a lot about Vlad. You wrote volumes and volumes about him, having seen him hit like so few before. For someone like you, I think when the last time we spoke, you had your confidence in Vladimir Guerrero Jr. was not shaken. Still feels pretty good, probably, just to be able to see him do the things that everyone knew he could do at the highest level of the game, almost in a way that probably even better, right? Like you, no matter how good a prospect is, you can't say he's going to go and have an 1100 OPS for a full half season hitting 28 home runs.
You can do it for anybody. It might have been Vlad Jr. I actually, when I published, I published an eyewitness report, or was in my blurb for the Blue Jays list that off season. I think I said he was, I mean, it's 7 hits, 7 power. And a scout buddy of mine saw that and texted me and just like reamed me out. It's like, this is the easiest 8 hit, 8 power I've ever read. Like, I'm like, yeah, like I could write that, but I was like, no, just it's, come on, man. Like, you got to use the whole scale. Mm-hmm. Like the eights are there for a reason. And he was right. I should have just, you know, and taken my, like, sometimes you're wrong and maybe and like, whatever. He had only been 7 hits, 7 power. I read him at 8. It wouldn't matter. I get why he may have been, I don't want to say, why people were quicker to kind of sour on him than they might have been with a Fernando Tatis Jr. type, just because he really, given the profile, had to hit. Mm-hmm. But he was an above average hitter his first 2 years in the majors at 21 and 22.
And 20 and 21,
you're right. Those are incredibly good markers for future success. And yes, he hit the ball on the ground a little bit too much. You also have to keep in mind his age 21 season was in the middle of a global pandemic, mm-hmm. where they were not playing home games and you're playing in a completely different park with a weird travel schedule. So it just, like, you really got to throw 2020 out in a lot of ways. And I think we've seen that in a lot of cases with 2021 performance. So what you really have is a half season of him adjusting to major league pitching as a 20-year-old and being an above average hitter. Now, did I think he would immediately come out and hit 340 with 50 home runs? I mean, if I actually thought that, I would have written him as 8 hit, 8 power. But yeah, it's like, you can't, like, he is not, like, there are a lot of guys where I really have to sit and have a think. Or even if I see them for 3-4 games a week, where it's like, okay, what is this guy really? Is he going to be able to hit major league breaking stuff like the slider down and away, right on right? Is he really a shortstop? Does he do everything well enough? Can you position him? And you're like, is he like, all right, you know, like, he's a 55. I'm going to say the 55. Like, I don't feel great about it. I could, if you told me he was a 6, that's fine. Like the Vlad Jr., it's like 2 at bats. You're like, okay, this is going to be one of the best hitters in baseball. Like, it just, it's the text. The text is right there. Just, right. The scout also said to me, like, the shortest reports you write are 8s and 2s.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's true. And it's rare too. And I think that, I hope everybody, I think the All-Star game was a great example of him on a big stage with everybody watching and even the other players just being able to like revel it and enjoy it. Like, it's rare. It's rare that a guy comes in and looks the part and then every piece of the performance, aligns up with it, where the power is to all fields and he'll spit on anything, and he looks great doing it. So like 8-8
power. And again, like in some ways, I enjoy watching Bo Bichette at the plate more because it's like it's like funky. It's probably like a weird hipster thing, right?
It's novel. It's a bit more novel.
It's a bit more novel. It doesn't always doesn't look right. So it's like difference between, I don't know. It's like, he's like Vlad's like, I don't know. I'm not like, I'm trying to think of like a huge, like big concert I would have like wanted to see. So like Vlad's like Blondie, right? You go and see Blondie at the height of their powers at CBGB's. This is still kind of a fairly obscure reference. And Bo Bichette's like, you catch a weird Jonathan Richman Modern Lovers night at like a cafe.
Okay. Yeah. I get
it's just, like it looks a little like just everything's a little weird, and you might just that might really look bad. Like you might see him for two games and he goes 0-for-8 with a walk and 3 strikeouts, and he's just absolutely trying to dig out this slider down and away.
He's 0-2 in every single at bat.
And he's not like a guy that's gonna work his way back. It's not a good, like it's not a bad 2-strike approach into short time. But it's like, okay, like you threw me a fastball 98 out of the zone, I swung and missed. You threw me another fastball 98 out of the zone, I swung and missed. You're gonna throw it even higher this time, I'm just gonna hit it off the Green Monster. And it's just me like, yeah, try it again. Like, it's not gonna, like, I'll figure it out. And I'll be falling over the plate, hitting the ball to the freaking beach at Dunedin. It's just, it's like, and again, that's a swing. Like, Vlad's swing is leveraged, and you know, it's not maybe traditionally pretty. And like, you know, a right-handed swing is traditionally pretty per se, but you get it. But like Bo, it's just like, yeah, you'd never like, what are you doing? Who taught you to do that? But it like, it's like a full bat wrap, and he almost does an arm bar, and he's very like up, almost like up on his toes. And just like, he's like, it's like a caber toss almost, or like a hammer throw. He's like almost like he's doing a hammer throw when he's batting, but it's like, and he's like hitting like 290. It's not even like he's striking out a ton. Like he still hits singles. It's wild. I just love watching. He's a better shortstop than I thought he'd be too. Like I thought he could play there, but he just grinds it out. It's so, and the aesthetics are obviously great too, but just everything about him. I think he's listed at like 6'1", 180. I don't think he's either of those things. And he just absolutely yokes baseballs. It's great.
He really has impressed me personally with his right field approach. Like there'll be times when he goes up and he's like, I'm gonna hit the ball to right field here, and it's after one pitch, it's clear as day, like that was his plan in the dugout, in the on deck circle, and he gets in there, but he does it. And then the other thing that I've been really impressed with is his power to right center field, like the ability to go up there with that plan, and then I'd be like, I'm gonna drive that baseball way the hell out there to the alley. And like you said, he's like, you know, 6 feet, 180 soaking wet with bricks in it, like standing on bricks, but like it's no joke power out to that alley in right center.
You say he doesn't have a good approach, and like, look, it's not, you know, he's not Kevin Youkilis up there by any stretch of the imagination, or Brandon Nimmo, but the bat speed that he has and the combination of that and the barrel control, despite the length and the swing, allows him to decide to swing very late and still authoritatively drive the ball the other way. So he can wait and decide. He doesn't always make the best swing decisions anyway, but he can decide to, you know, okay, that's a fastball. All right, fine. Like it's Nathan Eovaldi at 98, but I can still get there, and I can hit hard to right field because I just have that level of obscene bat speed. And whether it's up in the zone or down in the zone or the little cutter running away from me, I'm confident I can hit it. And like, look, he's going to look bad up there a lot, but I would almost be like, in certain situations, I'd almost rather pitch to Vlad, cause I feel like I could pitch around him a little bit. Like I can maybe get him like, look, if I miss, it's going to go a long way. But I might be able to get him into a bad count, or maybe he fouls one off and I can get him to nibble a little bit or roll over one. Like I could throw the worst 0-2 pitch in the world and Bichette might hit it for a double. And that would like be in the back of my mind. Like how good of a weight, like what do I do? And like, I guess I should just throw a good slider down and away to him 0-2, but that would just like be in the back of my mind. Like, is he just going to golf this into right field? And sometimes he does. And sometimes he doesn't, but yeah, He's always been fun to watch. I think I may have told this story on the podcast before, or maybe a different one. I certainly told it on mine. But when I saw them on, in Hartford, Vlad was hitting behind Bichette, and Bichette actually worked this like a bat against this like kind of nondescript lefty middle reliever in the seventh inning of a double A game. And he, you know, fouled a couple like little changeups down and away off, got to 3-2, drew a walk, like a 7 or 8 pitch at bat. You know, I don't think it was a particularly high leverage situation or anything. It just, I think I'd already done most of my notes on these guys. And I'm watching Vlad watch it in the on deck circle. I think I got put like two guys on. I'm like, oh God, I know exactly what's going to happen here. He's going to zone a fastball and hit it out of the stadium. And he zoned a fastball and hit it out of the stadium. And you can't really teach that either. Like he just watched the previous at bat. It's like, okay, this guy's struggling a little bit. He's nibbling. There's guys on now. I'm just going to swing out of my shot. Like he's going to, if it's close to the zone, I'm crushing it. And you know, he can go and do that too. You know, it's very much, this is sort of the cliche comp, but it's, you know, if it was Vlad Sr. with a better approach, and man, that guy's a Hall of Famer, and you don't comp Hall of Famers. And I mean, by the same token, Vlad Sr. never had a season like this.
No.
I don't know if he's going to do it for the whole year. I don't know if this is just going to end up being the best season of his career, but he never had a season like this. And that's wild.
It is wild. And seasons like this don't come around that often. And the best part about it is, well, from Blue Jays perspective, is there's nothing about it seems fraudulent. Nothing about it seems fake.
Yeah, it's
right.
He might be a little bit like, maybe he's really a true talent, 1,000 OPS guy that's having a better season than that. But like, it's not, oh yeah, sorry. He's only like 320, he's only like a 320, 400, 600 hitter, really. So
that's you know, you take it if you have to. Yeah. If forced, you know, if you know, you got me, you twisted my arm. Jeff, thank you so much for taking the time. I really appreciate it. Tell the people where they can find you and what they can look for from you coming up maybe the rest of the week.
So I write a Baseball Prospectus where I'm the lead prospect writer. I wrote a Jaron Duran call up for a game that didn't happen. I don't do a lot of draft coverage. Keenan Lamb's our senior draft writer. You know, he did our big board chats. He's got some draft recap stuff coming. I did try to kind of peg where each of the first round picks will be ranked in their system. I now forget what I said for Gunnar Hoglund, which is probably something I should have looked at before I did this podcast hit, but not number one. Like I think I said like 4th to 7th or something like that. The injury does make it difficult. My editor, Craig Goldstein, has already reminded me that I was going to write a piece off the midseason 50 list that went up on Friday that you can also see. It's still evergreen content. I know it feels like between the futures game and everything else that it already, like every list we put out already feels old 24 hours after it came out, let alone, I guess, 9,620 at this point. Oh, almost a full week, however many hours that is. I never know what day it is at this point either.
You work in baseball. That's part of the deal.
It's part of it. You can check that out. I theoretically might write a piece tonight still because I don't go to bed until like 3 a.m. But it'll be players that I call them. Oftentimes I get chat questions about a player that missed the midseason 50. I'll say, well, he's a top 101 guy, but he's not a midseason 50 guy. So I'm going to write about some top 101 guys, but not midseason 50 guys. If it doesn't go up tomorrow, it'll go up next week. And you can follow me on Twitter at Jeff Paternostra.
You can do that. And I will often, what am I trying to say? I want to say have a great night. And I want to say thank you so much for taking the time to join us on this post-draft edition of Spin Wheel.